I fell in love with the sport in the 1994 World Cup. That's when the dream started for me, and that's where the passion for the sport, because I got to go to a World Cup game at Foxborough. It was South Korea versus Bolivia. Didn't know a single player on either team. Didn't know where the countries were, but my father came home with 4 tickets. So my brother, my mom, and myself. So we went. We took a long, car ride from New Hampshire to Foxborough Stadium. I saw the fans. I saw the face paint. I saw every race, every color, all coming together. And then the wave, it was the first time I saw the wave in a stadium, and it was 0-0. There were no goals. Yet I thought it was the best thing on earth that doesn't get better. And from that, I was infected with the love of the game. And from that point on, I said, this is what I want to do. This is where I want to play. I want to play in front of this many people in this type of crowd. And that's kind of where it's all began for me, where it started. And I had a bracket. I filled out the whole World Cup. And then I just wanted to kind of practice, because I knew if I did that, I maybe one day would be able to play in a stadium like that.
Growing up in such a crazy environment, was the game that, I guess, that one platform, the one scenario where you had stability, whether it be with your father or your brother, is that what made you kind of drawn to it?
Now that you think say that, I think about it, probably. The weekends were kind of just soccer 24/7. Right. I would wake up at 6 a.m. and I would play for a team at 7 a.m. For indoor soccer. Let's say indoor soccer season. So, and for in New Hampshire, indoor soccer season started like in November, beginning of November. Right. It would last till March, you know? So on weekends, it would be 6 a.m. start. It would be a game at 6 a.m. We'd wake up at 5, get there at 6, play the game at 6, 6 to 7. I'd play for a new team from like 8 to 9. And I played for another team, 9 to 10. And then it'd be kind of like a tournament. And it would just go until 6 or 7 p.m. every single weekend. Saturdays and Sundays were like that. Then you go to fall and spring season with club. I'd play for 3 teams. And so I'd have probably 3 games every weekend. And it would be all over New Hampshire. And then when I got to being, I think when I turned 12, my father started taking me to Massachusetts to play with men. In the right. Portuguese adult leagues. So I'd be, 13, 14 playing against grown men. And when you do step overs against kids and you make them look silly and they fall down, you laugh, whatever, you can dribble and score goals. You do that against grown men, they're kicking you.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the hardest lesson, or the biggest lesson I learned, which also turned into a hard lesson, was I did a rainbow over a semi-pro player. I was 14 years old. Did a rainbow over him. I'm running around him. He comes with this hand and grabs me by the throat and throws me down and then picks me up by the shirt and says, if you ever do that again, I'll break your leg. And I thought to myself, okay, I guess, you have to play a certain way. You have to play with respect right. at the same time. Like, was that needed to get by him? Probably not. I wanted to show I could do it. And, it was those type of things that I was thrown out to the wolves, so to speak, with my father, because he thought that would be the best for me to learn and the best for my development to show, how it is when you play with men.
It's funny you mention that, because my father growing up had the same mentality where he wanted the structure side of youth soccer because he loved that. But he would throw me into play men's league as soon as he thought I was ready for it. And he thought I needed to learn more. The word in Spanish is picardía, es colmillo. It's that savviness, that game yes. savviness, or that sometimes we lack here. He wanted me to learn that, and it's exactly what you're talking about: knowing in what moments you can do what, knowing how to get away with things when you don't have the size or the strength or maybe something that your opponent has. Now, you showed flashes of brilliance very early on. You're obviously a very physical kid. We'll get into high school right now, mm-hmm. but your physical attributes growing up, I'm sure, just overpowered the majority in your age group. What was that like growing up? When did you realize you were good and you had a future? And I imagine bigger and better things started coming?
To tell you the truth, I was always fast. So right. Quickness and speed, that was my thing. But I was really small. I think I was small for my age. And getting out muscled, that was something that happened to me quite a bit. So when you talk about being a striker and having to deal with bigger center backs, quickness and speed, that's how I got around them and being able to be agile. But as far as winning 50-50 challenges and winning aerial duels, that never happened for me. It wasn't until high school. I went to a boarding school, which, you show up. It was probably it is the best thing that happened to me in my life outside of marrying my wife is going to this boarding school. And the reason why, sure, I had a dysfunctional family, if that's the way that a lot of people would put it.
And you don't consider it that way though.
I don't, because there was, with all the dysfunction, there was still love, and there was still, I was, every Christmas, my parents made sure I had presents.
Right.
And looking back at something like that, that made a huge difference in my life to wake up on Christmas Day and for there to be presents for me to unwrap. And I'll never forget that. Sure, there were times where being man of the house, I'd have to go to a grocery store with food stamps. This is one of the lowest points in my childhood. Going to a grocery store with my brother. So I'm taking my brother. We walk to the grocery store. So you're walking through Manchester, New Hampshire. It's a city. You know, you're walking through basically, you know, congested, you know, streetways. You go to the store. We're shopping for things that we think we need, right, to eat. And we're going through the checkout line. We have to pay with food stamps, with paper food stamps. And the checkout line lady says, aisle eight, like loudspeaker. Everyone's looking at my brother and I as we're checking out the whole store. I don't know how to process these. What are these? Loud, over the speaker. Everyone's staring. And then the lady's like, it's food stamps. They're food stamps. So everyone can see us. I've never felt so embarrassed. Even though I'm a child, I shouldn't be embarrassed. It's not my fault.
But it's traumatic.
Traumatic. So my brother and I then carry the bags and we walk all the way home. And it's not like you just have one bag. We had bags and we're walking home. That was a traumatic point in my life. But with that being said, they still made us dinner, provided us food, and we had presents every Christmas. And those are the moments that stand out to me. Plus, you throw in driving us all over the state. No matter where the game was or what time the game was, if my father couldn't drive me, a teammate could drive me, or another assistant coach. I always got to my games. And so for that, I'll always be appreciative of the fact that as dysfunctional as it was, there was still a lot of love there and sacrifice to provide for us.
Absolutely. So take me to Brooks College. Brooks School. Obviously, it's an important chapter of your life. You not only played soccer, I mean, you broke every single record that there is to have there. You also wrestled, and people don't realize you were a pretty damn good wrestler as well. You're a state champion. You're a strong kid. The first time I remember seeing you, I mean, we're roommates in Copa America in Venezuela, and this kid's got some legs on him. Look, this kid's like short, stocky, he's powerful. You can tell you were a strong kid.
Yeah. So the Brooks School, it's $30,000 a year to go to this school, and it's a high school. No, forget college, right?
Right. And
we're poor, as poor as can be. But my father played soccer with the head coach of the soccer team, who was also head of the math department. And he ran into him at a soccer jamboree, random. And then he put into my father's head the idea of going to a boarding school, applying to one, and what that could do for me. My father was dead set on sending me there. Best decision he ever made as well. So I get in. I did well in school because my father and my mother were strict about education. You got to be smart. You got to have a good head on your shoulders. So I get in. They force you to play three sports. So
they force you.
Yes, it's mandatory to play three sports your freshman year at the very least. So go in, soccer done, fall. Sophomore year, I try out for basketball, and I played youth church league basketball in New Hampshire. I wasn't good. I was super fast, didn't know how to shoot, couldn't shoot for my life. Layups were okay. I go to try out. My advisor, was the head basketball coach. So I'm like, oh, I'm a shoo-in. I don't want, you know, you're a freshman. You want to be on three varsity sports as a freshman.
Right.
Go in, try out. Horrible. Don't make it. He's like, JV is, you need to be on JV. I was kind of distraught. But my Spanish teacher was like, hey, we have a varsity spot open on the wrestling team. I was like, ah, oh, wrestling. The most I knew about wrestling was The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Right.
So
right.
I was like, ah, oh, wrestling. Like, but I did because it was varsity. And it was, again, so important for my development as a soccer player because of the speed, the strength, but the mental toughness needed to win. And you're out there on your own. Sure, you have to practice and train. But when you're out there on your own on the mat, it's just you and your opponent. And you have to outthink him, outsmart him. You have to react. You have to have balance. And all of that combined just made me that much better of a soccer player. The confidence and the strength. And like you said, you start getting bigger. So my legs ultimately got bigger. My being more physical on the field, I think that showed after wrestling. And my freshman year, I won New England's. So I won New England's as a freshman. And then my sophomore year, I was an All-American. I placed eighth in the country. So it kind of just grew. And I love the sport because of I saw the benefits from it.
People don't realize that in football and soccer, it doesn't matter how big you are. It does you no good if you don't know how to use your body. And my brother wrestled in high school, and that's the one thing. He later went on to fight in the UFC, but it's the one thing. They're very in tune with their body and how strong they are and how they can use said strength.
Did you play any other sports growing up?
I did. I ran track, and I actually wrestled for a bit, but the seasons are different in Nevada, so I couldn't. I wanted to do football. I wanted to kick, you know, listen, I'll kick a field goal right now, 60 yards. I haven't done anything. It's just
the Patriots could use you over here.
But the thing is, I don't know how accurate I'd be, but I got some distance on it. You know what I'm saying? So I absolutely played. I wish I would have done more, but soccer completely controlled everything in Nevada for me. The seasons didn't align. But like I was telling you, my brother, I mean, he used wrestling as a, I guess, escape from life as well. And he used it to funnel his way into jiu-jitsu, which turned into the UFC. So there's a lot of wrestling background, I would say, in our family, but very much so. And he's a short, stocky kid as well. He's like 5'6". He's a cop now in Nevada, but he very much knows how to use his body.
I mean, yeah. Was it the same way for you in Nevada as it was for me growing up, where you're traveling everywhere to play the sport? Was it?
No, because I don't know what soccer was like in Massachusetts, but in Nevada, I was U14 and we were already playing at a U18 level because there wasn't enough teams. Right. So in Southern Nevada, you don't have enough teams. So we're 13 years old and we're already playing against grown men. We're playing against 18-year-olds, which is kind of this men's league mentality we spoke about. You have to learn how to do different things and you get better that way. But no, the game wasn't where it is today.
All right. Yeah. I mean, New Hampshire, it wasn't the most popular sport to play, and in Manchester, New Hampshire in particular, no one really played it. They called me a soccer bunny, you know, at times. And that's what I kind of pushed me to play Pop Warner football. So I played Pop Warner football for 2 years because that was initially my love. Like, I loved football. That was the first sport that I watched. And so I played it every day with the kids in my neighborhood. And when I came home from school one day in first grade, I thought I was giving my father a permission slip to play Pop Warner football. Instead, it was tryouts for soccer. And I saw his eyes light up and he was so excited and happy. You know, he's from Gambia. So being born in Gambia, that's the only sport you know. So he didn't want to push me to play unless I came, you know, to him and said, hey, I want to play. And so I did, not knowing that it's actually, tryouts for soccer. And from that point on, I could never say, oh, I don't want to play, because I saw how happy and excited he was. And I always wanted, you know, his approval. Like, I was always working to have him say, like, you were great or you were awesome, because he never did that. I could score four goals in a game and he'd be like, oh, you missed that play there. You should have scored, you know, two here. You should have beat this guy. It was always that. And I was always trying to, you know, win his love and win his approval. And I think that also pushed me to be better.
In that, I guess, willingness to seek his approval, that continued throughout your career. I know that you guys speak after every single game and he gives you kind of a rundown of what he saw in said game, of what he feels you could do better. Mm-hmm. this always, it never faltered. It always continued throughout your career.
Yeah. It was one of those things where he knows the game so well. And I knew coming from him, he's going to give me the honest truth and what he thinks. There were some games where he said, there's not too many things you did wrong. Right. And you're like, oh, and he's like, except that. And you're like, I do recognize that I didn't do that right. Or I should have made that pass, or I should have continued that run. But for the most part, he was always trying to get me better. It was never, he didn't want me to ever settle or be satisfied, like always shoot to be the greatest. And that stuck with me. So, whenever I had a game, we definitely talked after he was sure to give me his feedback.
All right, let's move ahead now to Boston College. You ended up playing in Boston College for about how long?
So I played 2 seasons, but I was there for until my junior fall, because in my sophomore fall first game, I tore my meniscus against Farley Dickinson University, where Alejandro Bedoya was playing. Actually, that's the game that we BC recruited him to transfer.
Okay, so you ended up in Alejandro Bedoya, and we'll get into the national team guys in a bit, but I want to concentrate on you leaving Boston College.
Mm-hmm.
You leave Boston College, you think you're ready for the pros.
Yes.
First question is, because I know you trialed at Ajax.
Yes.
That didn't go your way.
No.
Was there anything that could have been done by Major League Soccer to get you to Major League Soccer, or was your mindset, I'm going to Europe?
So sophomore year, I played in the Milk Cup in Northern Ireland with the youth national team. And that came after being the last cut, the final cut before the U20 World Cup for my age. I was an alternate. And that was devastating, because you work so hard, you had played so well, and I thought for sure I'm a shoe-in, and you get cut. The team goes and does pretty well, relatively well. But I didn't give up, and then this opportunity came to go represent the U.S. at the Milk Cup. We win. I get Golden Boot. I get the MVP of the tournament. And, it was the first time the U.S. had won that Milk Cup tournament. Excited. A lot of scouts were watching. So now I'm thinking, okay, I'm back on the radar in Europe. And my dream had always been to play in Europe. Always. Sophomore year comes. I'm looking forward to leaving after this year. And my mindset was, I'm going to play sophomore year at Boston College and then turn pro, because there's going to be opportunities for me. First game of the year, I'm like, feeling myself. I do step overs. It's the first couple minutes of the game. Beat a guy and then cross it in the middle, tap in 1-0. I'm like, all right, this season is going to be, it's going to be good. We're in the ACC for the first year. We switched from Big East to ACC. I'm like, now I'm going to shine this year. Next play, probably 10 minutes later, half field, I check for a ball. The defender, center back, comes in, says, nope, we're not having that today. Slide tackles me from behind. I tear my meniscus. They tell me, full repair, you're out 5 months. I'm thinking, oh, man, what does this mean? I always thought, if you get a knee injury, surgeries, you're done. You're going to lose you're going to lose speed. I know all these things. I went into a depression. It was a difficult 5 months. When those 5 months are up, BC, we're in the spring season, and we're playing the Revolution, New England Revolution. And I was like, that was kind of my motivation throughout rehab, was to get back for this game. I get back for this game. So I'm a little nervous. Am I going to have the speed? Am I going to have the quickness? Can I still play at a high level? First 10 minutes of the game, there's a cross comes in. I hit a bike, 1-0 us. And then, second half, I took Michael Parker's 1v1, scored. We ended up winning the game 3-1. The Revs were playing Clint Dempsey, Shalrie Joseph, Taylor Twellman, Ralston.
This was 2006?
This was 2006.
They had teams that went to back-to-back MLS Cups, correct?
Yeah. Like, it's one of the best teams in the league.
Right.
And they had and this was probably a week before their season started, or 2 weeks before their season. So I was thinking, wow. I still got it. I'm good. Play another year of college. And during that time, a lot of European teams were coming to watch me at college games. So, Lyon and Celtic and Roma and Ajax, all these teams were flying to Boston to watch me play, scouting me. And then so
They're watching college games. They're scouting college games.
Yeah. In particular, they were scouting.
Was that normal at that time, Charlie?
No, it was not normal. And I had worked with a friend, and the reason how this all started was there was a kid that I went to high school with who then went to Dartmouth who was in marketing. He was studying to be, you know, he wanted to be a head marketing exec and in sports. So he started doing all these videos and highlights of me from college, from high school, and sending them out to all these top clubs. And within those highlights were the U.S. Milk Cup goals and represent the youth national teams.
Right.
And so they all started coming to Boston to watch my games and watch me in person. And I would see them every time I'm coming out to a game. I would see, you know, these people with clipboards or, you know, with, you know, European soccer gear. I know who is here to watch me. So
you can pick them out.
Right. I'm excited. Season ends. Then comes Nike. So Nike comes out, Brad Self flies out and says, you know, we want to sign you. No brainer. Nike has always been, I'm still with Nike now.
Right.
It was always a dream because of Thierry Henry and Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, right? They wore Nike. Yeah. I wanted to be like them. They had the Vapors. I was wearing Vapors. I signed directly. I was so excited. And then, so
the moment you sign, your eligibility is done.
Right. And I knew that. So actually the first thing I did was I signed with Lyle Yorks. So I listened to Rich Motzkin. I listened to Lyle Yorks. I listened to, who else was out there?
Mike Garland.
Mike Garland was with, Lyle at the time. So Garland is the one who flew out and signed me.
Okay.
Cause I think Lyle was in Europe or something.
And yeah, Michael Bradley's agent, forget his name. There's Dan Siegel. There's Motzkins. There's, mm-hmm. Ooh, I'm forgetting his name. It's going to drive me nuts. But anyways, Lyle and Motzkins are the two biggest.
So those are the two big ones. I was good friends with Freddie Adu. So at the time, so Freddie was telling me, hey, go with Motzkin. He's great. He'll get you this and this and this.
Right. Well, he got Freddie everything.
right. And he had, so Lannon and Freddie were his golden gooses, right? So when you look at that, you're like, oh, okay, those are the two top guys in the U.S. right now. But Lyle had all the guys in Europe. Right. So he had Clint, he had Beasley, he had Gooch, you know, all these guys, Bocanegra, right? So all these guys playing in Europe, and I always wanted to play in Europe. Mm-hmm. So that was why I chose Lyle. If I was staying in MLS, I would have signed with Rich Motzkin at the time. But now, knowing that I was going to go to Europe, I signed with Lyle. Then MLS came. And I said, okay, we want you to be Generation Adidas. You know, you'll be the highest paid Generation Adidas player of all time up to that point. So you have a guaranteed offer or you go to Europe on a chance, on a trial.
Right.
And so I told them it really didn't, the money of this contract really didn't, wasn't going to impact my decision of staying in MLS. It was always my dream and my goal to play in Europe. And I want to continue to believe in myself and take that chance.
Charlie, that's almost crazy when I hear you talk about your childhood and you and your brother Justin walking into the grocery store and using food stamps to buy groceries. And here you are with somebody offering you to make you the highest paid in the league for Generation Adidas in their history. And you still want to bet on yourself. You want to bet on yourself in this European dream.
Yeah. I was that confident that I could play in Europe. And two, I knew if I wanted to be the best player I can possibly be, I need to be tested and I need to go overseas and show what I can do.
So it didn't happen in Ajax. How long was the training spell for?
Yeah. So I fly to Ajax with Lyle, and off the plane, I'm playing a friendly right off the plane with the reserves. And I'm like, they're like,
great circumstances. We're
not expecting you to just light it up and do well, but we just want to see kind of basically your movement. The game was already scheduled, so they want to see what I could do with some of their top reserve players. The game was okay. I think we ended up winning, you know, 1-0 or 2-0. I played probably 70 minutes. So it wasn't a poor performance, but it wasn't a great performance. And I remember Lee Wynn came because he was playing at PSV. So he came to check out the game. And Lee was huge in me signing with Lyle because I was really tight with Lee. And, Lyle represented Lee, and Lee had nothing but great things to say about Lyle. So I was like, okay, let's do this. So the next match I played during this week, it was a 7-day trial. The next match I was staying, also I was living at Vermilion's home. Vermilion was at this one of these parent homes that they have for young IX players who play with the first team. They stay with like a family, a host family. So I was staying with his old host family, and it was pretty cool because they would tell me stories about Vermilion and, you know, him being, you know, a captain. And then I think he got transferred to Arsenal. So, you know, it was a pretty cool circumstance. The food was pretty bland, but second game I score a hat trick. And I remember I was on fire. I was doing everything right. I was the movement, the goals themselves, you know, dribbling three or four guys. I was just doing everything right, making plays for other people. And Schneider's father was there on the sideline sitting there with Lyle. And he was like, this guy's going to be special.
Wesley Schneider.
Yeah. Wesley Schneider's father was with Lyle and was like, this guy's going to be special. You know, so I remember Lyle telling me that and I was like,
What happened then?
So the last game, which is when they had all the first team coach, the you know, sporting director, the right. owner, everyone is there, right? I'm performing. 10 minutes in, I pull my hamstring. I strain it. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, just carry through. You'll be fine. You know, we were playing a Dutch team that wasn't that strong. So I felt like, oh, I can still show out. I couldn't run properly. I couldn't really do anything. I had a horrible performance. And like, we understand that's, you know, you're injured, but we can't sign you. You could stay for another 2 weeks. So you got to, you know, basically recover from this strain and then try again, basically.
Wow.
And so at that point, I was like, oh, what am I going to do? Because I've already turned down MLS. So that option is kind of gone. Hammerby from Sweden calls my agent and says, we have a contract offer for you. So come to fly to Stockholm. You'll be playing with the first team as opposed to playing with the reserves and with Ajax. It's a great opportunity. Come sit down, have dinner with the coach and see if this is the right fit for you. We flew right to Stockholm, sat down with Tony Gustafsson, who was the women's US national team assistant coach just a couple years ago. He sat down, told me this is the plan. He's seen me play. He's played in college soccer, so he knows where I'm coming from. Everyone in Stockholm speaks English. It won't be so hard to adapt. And he sees a big plan for me. I'm part of that plan. And so I said, all right, let's do it. Sign the contract. And that's kind of how life began with me in Stockholm.
So let's mix these two together. What is life at Hammarby at the beginning? And I know you struggled to get going at Hammarby at the beginning. And then you get called up to the U.S. men's national team. I believe the game was in California, if I'm not mistaken, versus China?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So that game, you get your debut. Mm-hmm. And then this was around the same time that the U.S. men's national team was playing in the Gold Cup and had that ridiculous Benny Fallhaber golazo for the win in Chicago. We are actually there later on that day. Because you, myself, and you most would consider the B team is going now to Copa America in Venezuela to participate in this tournament. Give me your overall impressions of your first national team camp, what it was like being around the players, your interactions with Bob, just everything that entails the I made it to the national team moment.
So first camp with Hammarby, because they were owned by AEG as well. So we, same company as the Galaxy. Our first camp is in January. So in LA, and we scrimmaged the U.S. men's national team January camp. And I remember being like, wow, I'm on the field with a lot of these guys that, you know, are role models to mine, you know, that I look up to.
Right.
And I played okay. I think I showed, sometimes I isolated guys being 1v1, but for the most part, it was kind of like happy to be with my new club and getting, you know, back into the swing of things. During the year, I started the first four games with Hammarby. Things were going well, but I couldn't score. And then that kind of, I just had a mental block. I could not score. And so after those four games, Tony said, you know what? I think it's best you start coming off the bench and I'll take the pressure off. I took that as more disrespect. You're getting demoted. You're not good enough to start. So dealing with the mental block of not scoring, and then also thinking that the coach thinks you're not good enough, and then therefore guys on the team think, oh, you're not good enough.
Right.
That was just like stuck in my brain. I just kept fighting, and I played, but I just couldn't score. And I did some great things on the pitch, but as a striker, you're evaluated on your goals, your production.
Right.
And I wasn't scoring. And I know they, the fans, the club, the team, the coach, they all expected me to be producing right away with the investment that they put in me. So I go to, I get called up by Bob to come to, the camp in the summer before that friendly against China. So I was like, oh, so excited. And I'll never forget coming to the training camp, and you get on the bus and you see Landon and you see Bees and you see Tim Howard and Bocanegra and Gooch. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like, this is real.
Right.
And training with them. And just being like, wow, this is as good as it gets. And I want to be a part of this all the time. And then we flew out to China, to San Jose to play China. We whooped China. I'm the first sub in the game, playing up top. I think I took Ante Razov, I think, started. I can't
remember. Ante Razov. Wow. Yeah. What a shout.
Jesse Marsh got his first cap in that game as well.
That's right. Correct. I think his only, right?
Yeah. So, the game gets played. I didn't do anything of real notice, I guess. Go back to Sweden, and the struggle continued for the whole rest of the summer. But then Bob gives me the opportunity to come in for Copa America. Oh, I'm like, this is awesome to go to Copa America. And I think you will be on the same page as me when you think about what took place against in that first game. Because that was my first time really being starstruck. When you see that Argentina squad, which is – I would put that squad up against any squad that I can't believe they didn't win that tournament.
Yeah, because you remember that tournament they played Brazil in the final, and Brazil had just gotten smashed by Mexico in group play, embarrassed. And that Argentina team, I mean, they had Messi when he was coming up. They had Crespo. They had Riquelme. They had
Zanetti, Cambiasso.
Zanetti, yes, Cambiasso.
Tevez on the bench. Saviola on the bench.
It's insane. It was an insane
Pablo team. Aymar. Like, are you kidding me?
Mascherano, I think, was on there too. You know, like, it's a ridiculous team. And it's funny because I always tell the story, like, how'd it go? I was like, we had him 1-1, halftime.
We had him 1-0. We scored first.
Exactly. Correct. I mean, it was a penalty kick. Do you remember what happened at halftime in the tunnel?
No.
It was Eddie Johnson.
Yes, switching jerseys with somebody.
Oh, yes. But Eddie Johnson and Benny getting into it in the tunnel.
I remember that as well.
There was also like a bit of a circus. It's like I'm in awe of this Argentine team and that we're like hanging with them, hanging in air quotes, with them, in the scoreline. And then halftime comes and here we are fighting with ourselves. I'm like, what's going on?
If you could look back in the first half, one player – who surprised you the most with their performance in that first half?
I think it'd be two players, and it was both players that were fighting with
each other.
If you have to pick one. From our team or from the Argentine team?
Our team.
Honestly, I thought Eddie was unreal.
I think the best performance that probably went unnoticed was Jonathan Bornstein on Messi.
Johnny's one of those figures that never gets the credit, and I will 100% agree with you, and one day I want to bring him on because he's insanely consistent at a position that the U.S. men's national team has always been inconsistent at.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you 100%.
He was great that first half. I mean, he shut down Messi. Messi was kind of irrelevant that first half. You're overshadowed when you have Riquelme, who was just gliding all over the field. And
he would walk and just kill you.
Oh, it was just a thing of beauty.
It really was. So this tournament's happening. You're getting your first taste. You have the luxury of having myself as a roommate. It's nothing but good times. I remember we spent 70% of the time laughing at YouTube or these videos on the net. Eddie Johnson would always come on by, and he was always making us laugh. And it was a very good environment. It was fun. Mm-hmm. We didn't do so well. We had a very young squad. I mean, the majority of us were 24 years old or younger, 25 or younger.
But if we had the A team, don't you think they would have done well?
Of course.
I think you get out of the group. And then from there, I think it's kind of, you know, depending on your performance on that game, but, and what team you get matched up with. But I thought the level was a level that we would compete at, you know, like
Correct.
we would probably be the better of those teams that were in the group outside of obviously Argentina, even though played Argentina,
Colombia, and Paraguay. It was a tough group. That was an extremely tough group. You had some very good players on the other side, but you're absolutely right. You go in with the A team and it's a different story. Listen, we were kids. A lot of us were getting our first national team taste, sprinkling in with a few veterans like, Jay DeMeritt, who wasn't really a veteran, you know, of the national team, but he had been
Ben Olsen,
pro. Ben Olsen, Casey Keller,
Taylor
Twellman, Big Head was there as well.
Yeah. Twellman, Olsen,
Eddie, Benny,
Casey Keller,
Lee Wynn.
Was Chris Albright on that?
No, Albright wasn't there. I'm trying to think. It was the center back who played for Houston.
Bobby Boswell.
Bobby Boswell was there as well. So we had a very seasoned team as far as like their respective clubs, but very young and naive at the national team level. Mm-hmm. So it was what it was at Copa. It was a good experience for you. You now translate that experience. And the last game of the season at Hammarby, you break out with not one goal, not two goals, but three goals. A hattie, your last game of the season. I'm sure it must have been a huge weight just lifted off your shoulders. Explain the emotion.
It was a game changer, right? Because you've struggled all year. And the fans stuck with me. That's why whenever I talk about Hammarby, I get excited. Whenever I see something about Hammarby, I get excited because of how they believed in me, how they stuck with me throughout that first season. It was a difficult time. You talk about having to learn and adjust to the professional lifestyle, being alone in Europe, living on my own. I couldn't cook for beans. I ate horribly, right? And then the temptation of Stockholm nightlife. It's phenomenal. You have, you know, great places. You have, my teammates were all young who were all wanting to, you know, go out and have fun. I think when you play in the Swedish league, you understand whether you're the first guy, the youngest guy on the team, whether you're 17, 18 years old or the oldest guy on the team, 35, 36, you're still like, you're all one. And the guys would all hang out together and they go, you know, drink coffee together. They go out and to clubs together. It was a great time. And during that time, I struggled because of being alone, being away from my family, I think the teammates expected me to produce. But if I was going to hang out with them and go out with them and do all those fun things, then you got to show up. And right. I would only show up for training, you know, and do really well, probably two trainings a week. And I thought that was good enough. If I showed out two trainings a week, that's all you need. Then the coach said, no, you got to train that way every single day. And until you do that, you're not going to start. And it just ate at me. And then the last five games of the year, he started me. And the first game he started me was against Henrik Larsson's Helsingborg. And I remember that was the first time I got to play against like an actual role model that I really loved and I idolized. And he took me aside and said, you know, keep working. It's all about work ethic and concentration. If you do that, you will succeed.
And Henrik Larsson pulled you aside.
Henrik Larsson. And I told him I was so amazed at the way he played. It was all about timing. Everything he did, you could be 7'2". He was going to win a header over you because he was that good. He knew how to use his body well and he knew how to time everything well. And his runs were just, I could sit back. They'd have the ball in our half and they would knock it from the side. And I would just focus on Henrik Larsson during the game. And I just watch his movement and he would float on someone's back shoulder and he'd wait. And then as soon as that outside back put his head down, he was on the move and he would get to a spot every time. And whether the ball was good or not, he'd always, and when it was near him, he got his head to it. He was that good. And then from that performance, I kind of used those words. I was like, okay, Henrik Larsson told me I have to focus every single play. I have to be tuned in. And I did that. In the last game of the year, my coach started me at right midfield the last game of the year. The first 30 minutes, I'm kind of right midfield. I don't really know how to, you know, how to defend and attack. It's a right. complex position, especially when you're talking about tactically, knowing when to shift inside, correct. Knowing when to get back outside, and knowing if you're going to push up on the left back or if are you going to cover the left midfield, and being responsible from literally end line to end line. 30 minutes goes by. He goes, all right, move up top. So I move up top, and then that's when I score the first goal to end the first half. And I run to my coach, I run to Tony Gustafsson, and I give him the biggest hug because I knew what that meant to get that monkey off my back last game of the year and what that would mean for me the following year. But more so, how he stuck with me and how he pushed me to get to be at that level. Second half starts, I think within the first 10 minutes, I get the second one. And then, you know, everything's flowing. Everything's working right. Right. And now I get the loose. Third. Volley yeah. comes in, it bounces, gets flicked out. I wait for it, I time it, volley it. Hat trick. And I think that's when I realized the fans realized, the club realized, everyone realized we have something here. And right. I knew this was going to be my launching point. And I never looked back.
And it was the next season you scored something like 14 goals in 27 games, which is ridiculous. And we can go on to that season and talk about everything about it. But I want to move forward and I want to talk about the Confederations Cup. You're now a national team, I guess, fixture. You're appearing, you know, semi-regularly with the national team now with Bob Bradley, and you guys have this experience of playing the Confederations Cup. And it wasn't all roses. Everybody remembers the great run that was to make it to the final and play against Brazil, yeah. and you took those guys to the brink. But you guys started off the tournament with a loss. It was 3-1 to Italy. Giuseppe Rossi comes off the bench and bags two. American-born Giuseppe Rossi.
Who were you trying to get to play for us forever?
Correct.
Turned us down.
Right. The yeah. same one that Bruce famously said, we're not chasing 18-year-olds. We're good. So immediately with the loss, the second game, you're playing against Brazil. Brazil smashes the States. Sasha Kljestan gets a red card in minute 57. It's not a good game. So already two losses. You're now mm-hmm. going into the last game. I believe you start this game, correct?
Yes.
You started this game, it's against Egypt, and then you start off the scoring. It's one of these goal scorer goals. It's you sniff it out, you're at the right place, the right time. These goals that happen all the time to goal scorers. Walk me through that game and where everything, because this is really the game where everything changes.
Mm-hmm. So to start the tournament, we played early. I came in as a sub.
Right.
And, you know, I had played so well with my club that I was ready for this. I felt like I was ready for this opportunity. And then we get a corner kick. I think it's 1-1 at the time. So we scored first. They've scored. I come in the game. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get on the score sheet. We have a corner kick. I'm like, all right, perfect. Landon takes it. I get in to a perfect spot around the 6-yard box. And I see the ball coming. I'm like, it's coming right to me. It's coming right. It clears the first man on the six. I'm like, it's coming right to me. And I'm looking at Buffon. And I'm like, I'm going to score on Buffon. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And I sky it over. And I'm like, ah. Oh. And then we lose that game. I don't touch the field against Brazil. So therefore, you would think it's done for you. And it's done for right. the team, this group, right? But in the training session, it was all the players who hadn't really played leading up for that Egypt game. And I thought, okay, if there's ever an opportunity to make a point that you want to start this game, train well. And I had the training of my life in the training before Bob was going to make that decision. I had the training of my life. I was on fire. I every time I touched the ball, I scored and I was beating someone or I was passing, I was creating a goal right. from someone. It was just unstoppable. And then the next day, he makes the starting 11 and he's like, we're only making two changes. Brad Guzan in goal. And I'm like, oh, damn, like not good enough. Maybe I'll come off the bench. And he's like, Charlie, you're starting up top with Josie.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, okay. Amped. And I knew I was ready this time. I was like, okay, the Italy game, I let it get to me. This time I'm not. And I started off with a bang. I was just making runs, just trying to be aggressive. And in that goal against Egypt, Josie crosses it. The keeper, I think, comes out, misplays it. It bounces around. I see the ball pop out. Instantly, I'm like, muscle him. Muscle this outside back who's coming in. I muscle him. I get my body in between him and the ball. Then it was, okay, keeper, another defender. Let me try and like do a quick two touch and get a shot off. I'm able to do that and bounces off the keeper's head into the goal. I look just to make sure
that you're onside.
That I'm onside. The flag is down. I look at the ref to make sure he's not calling some crazy foul or something. No. And then I was like, okay, we got that start we needed. I do the knee slide. I'm excited. And then at the same time, I looked at Bob. He was kind of giving like the fist pump, like keep going. And I was like, okay, this is it. And then that first half, I was making great runs. I was getting opportunities. The game, I think what I added to the team was that dimension of stretching back lines now.
Correct.
Now they could play into space. I could get into that space. And now you're having Egypt run towards their goal and face their goal, and you're creating space for Landon and Clint on the outside spots who could come inside. And that was the game changer.
It's crazy because that's when the U.S. men's national was really at their best, when these two guys played in the midfield, because they were so good in tight spaces. And if you had that vertical game that you just explained, it opened things up for them, and it really allowed them to play make. So we go into, this is such a fascinating game for me, Charlie, because the next game is in the knockout round, and it's against not one of the best teams in the world, the best team in the world, the number one ranked team in the world, which is Spain. And they're on some ridiculous undefeated streak. It's 35 games, 35 matches unbeaten streak, and they're going to play against lowly United States. Now, I call this game the blueprint, because if you recall, I believe it was 2010 in the World Cup, Switzerland played them. And they said that they used the same blueprint as the United States to beat Spain. What is the mindset? What's the tactic going into this game? What does Bob tell you? Because you know Bob very well, like I know Bob very well. And if there's something that Bob Bradley is he's prepared.
Yes.
He doesn't leave any stone unturned. The days before, you're getting the USB drive in your computer. You're getting video files. You know who you're playing against. You know what the system is. Do you recall the tactic heading to that game?
Yes, and it was on my birthday. It's a game. It's a game I'll never forget. So we were going into this match, knowing that streak, knowing the players that Spain have, knowing how they just breezed into this knockout round. It was, let's cut out their midfielders, who were Xavi and Xabi Alonso. Josie and I would check back. And we would make their defenders beat us. So we're going to make Puyol and Sergio Ramos make the game, and not let Xavi and Xabi Alonso make the game.
Right, and Iniesta. Then
Iniesta was not playing in this match.
Oh, no.
I think that for them, he was added for the World Cup, and obviously he did his thing.
Yes.
So we were very fortunate that he wasn't part of this team.
Right,
but you had Fernando Torres, David Villa. Cesc Fabregas is the player who filled in for Iniesta. You still had Xavi Alonso. And then Sergio Ramos and Puyol were the two center backs. Piqué and Puyol were center backs. Sergio Ramos was right back. Capdevila was the left back. So if we made their defenders try and beat us and not allow Xavi and Xavi Alonso to dictate the game in tempo, that we would have, and we stayed compact, that we would have the best opportunity to really beat this team.
Which is risky, because if they do beat you, now they have numbers in a very good midfield.
Right. But at the same time, we were set up for counterattack, right? So we drop, we stay compact. And when they come up, because they're going to get frustrated when we're not allowing them to play through the midfield, that's when we can use the space in behind Sergio Ramos, in behind Capdevila, and expose them, which we were able to do very well.
Not only did you guys do that very well, I mean, you shocked the world. It was a 2-0 win. You set up the Josie goal that I still think Iker Casillas could have done more on, but you got to be there. You got to finish it. Josie,
I agree.
Yeah. I'm sure we've let Josie know many times.
I agree, but you talk about the buildup. So Clint and I,
the buildup is exceptional. The buildup, and that's one of the things about this tournament. Because let's fast forward to now Brazil. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys are up 2-0 in the final of the Confederations Cup, and the picture perfect example of a U.S. men's national team counterattack was you setting up Landon's goal. The 27th minute, you set up Landon's goal. And to me, that is the U.S. men's national team at their strength. And that's literally how you want to draw it up, that counter. I mean, you're finally playing against Brazil. You're starting for the U.S. men's national team. You're making a name for yourself. And then you set Landon up on this beautiful goal. Walk me through the play.
I believe it was a corner kick for Brazil. And I set up on our left side, but I was ready for anything to pop out. And I knew that if there is an opportunity to counter, I got to be the guy to make the break. Ricardo Clark gets on the ball and he sees me. He plays a ball straight in my path. I take off. And I know if I'm in an open space, no one's catching me. I just had that about me. I did have the pace, but I was very confident that if I get out and I'm on the break, no one is going to catch me. So I'm off, but I'm so far left, like almost on the touchline that I probably couldn't get an opportunity at goal. But I look to my right and I see Landon full speed, and he's in a good spot. If I can bend it around the defender who was kind of trying to be between me and Landon, he was right in the middle. If I could bend it around him with my left foot, Landon was going to score. That's how I felt. I was like, I just got to get this ball to his feet. Then it has to be hit perfectly. It's on my left foot. My left foot is not the best foot, but I was very capable of the left foot. So I see it. I pick out the pass. I kind of bend it around with my left foot, and Landon takes this magical touch where he chops, I think it was Ramirez. He chops him to his left foot. So Ramirez is left in the dust because he turns when the ball's going around him. He turns. And as he turns, he's moving, to the right side of the pitch, and Landon just chops him into the left and then buries it bottom right with his left foot. And I thought, one, what a fantastic goal. That was world class. That's as good as it gets. Amazing. And two, I assisted it. Like, yeah. So when I ran to Landon and to celebrate, I felt during that time, whether you scored, you assisted, or you watched, or you, as long as you're on the pitch, we always celebrated like we scored the goal. You know, it was always like a team goal. And I remember like dancing after that goal, like I had scored, because it was just, you're going up 2-0 against in a FIFA tournament, FIFA final against Brazil, the ultimate country to play in. We're up 2-0. So going into half, I think it all crept into our head that we had won. Because we had just beat Spain, and you're up 2-0 against Brazil. You're not thinking you're going to let that lead slip. I think we all got a little complacent, and that's what cost us.
Absolutely. They make a ridiculous comeback. You end up losing valiantly 3-2 the Confederations Cup. But that put the U.S. men's national team on notice worldwide. And I want to fast forward now. You and I played against Mexico probably during a height of what is that rivalry, where the United States and Mexico, it could go either way. Mexico no longer had this dominance over the States, where it was going to be, they're going to rout the States 5-0, 6-0. They had to work for it, and it was always difficult, and it always ended up really being whoever played as the host, whoever was the home country, or whoever had that game as the local, would end up winning. It was that important. It was that, I guess, minimal, the difference. Estadio Azteca, it's August 12th, 2009. Another Charlie-esque counter. You scored a ridiculous golazo. You become only the fourth American to score in the famed Estadio Azteca. The fourth American. You don't know how insanely jealous I am of this. You score a golazo, a banger. Trademark Charlie Davis celebration. You're dancing and you're singing with the corner flag.
Yeah.
And I still can see this till this day, raining cups of beer and bags of, we're going to call them agüita de riñón, which in Spanish means kidney water.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a nice euphemism.
Yeah. So you're getting all this raining on you, and I'm thinking, I'm like, oh my goodness, like U.S. men's national team could actually pull this off. They've never beaten Mexico in Azteca, yet alone in World Cup qualification. Walk me through that moment.
So, you know, if you were to go back to 1997, it was my first U.S. national team game I ever witnessed live, which was at Foxborough's U.S. versus Mexico World Cup qualifier. And it ended 2-2. But that was where I thought to myself, this is the game you need to play in. If you're an American playing on a national team, this is it. It doesn't get better playing against Mexico. Fast forward to that day, walking into Estadio Azteca and seeing plaques of Maradona and Pele, who had both played World Cup games in this stadium. You're talking about history with the best, the very best. This is a landmark that goes down as one of the best stadiums in the world of all time in history. It's right. It's like the Colosseum, right? You go in, and I remember that ball that Landon plays to me, and I was in a good spot, and I don't think too many players would have seen the run. Like, Landon had that ability to read the back line, to read where players would be, and to be a step ahead. He takes a great touch into the midfield, he picks his head up, and he spots me. I don't think a lot of players would have spotted me in that early start of my run, and he plays just a darting ball right to my feet where I could take that first touch in front of me. And then once I took that first touch to kind of set me up, I knew, okay, I'm going to get a shot on goal. I'm in. I take another touch and I see, I think it was Ochoa come out, and the whole left side of his goal was open. And I'm like, set up for me to just bang this home. And you know, you got to put a little curl onto it. And I just was able to get great contact and bend it around him. I knew if I hit it with enough pace, he wasn't going to be able to stop it. And it hits back on that. I had that moment where I jumped out of my body and I could see everything. I looked at the stadium. No one was moving. It was
95,000.
Quiet. Except for the 2,000 American fans that came to the game. I could see them jumping and going nuts. I run to the corner flag and no one else comes. And I'm like, what the hell? But Michael Bradley comes and celebrating. I'm seeing these things, and Michael Bradley comes to pull me away, to bring me back to our side. I'm like, is this not the best game you can play? Why are we not celebrating? And then after the game, they're like, because we're not wasting our energy. And right. Did you see what came at you in the corner? We're not trying to get hit by coins and batteries and bottles and bags. Like, come on now.
Yeah, exactly. It is an unbelievable goal and something I'm sure many Americans will never forget. So you secure a loan or secure a move to Ligue 1, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name. Tell me just the name of the team. Sochaux. Okay. Now, what comes next, Charlie, is I don't even know how to ask you, but it's before a World Cup qualifier against Costa Rica. You break curfew a few nights before, and you're involved in a fatal car crash in the Washington Parkway around 3:15 a.m. You hit a metal guardrail, and you wake up the next day, and you're in a hospital bed. Mm-hmm. Walk me through this.
So we just qualified for the World Cup on Saturday night. We're in Honduras. We beat Honduras in Honduras. So you have one of those memorable celebrations, like you had won an NBA championship, like you won the Super Bowl. All of us are in the locker room popping bottles of champagne, you know, spraying on each other. We just qualified for the World Cup, the ultimate competition to play in. As a kid, you dream of being able to play in a World Cup. So we're all celebrating. Everything's happy. Everyone's just like, it doesn't get better. In that moment, if I think back to it, that you're at your peak as far as happiness, and you know you're about to touch and play in a World Cup. So we fly to DC that night, Sunday. Bob's like, have day off. You know, party, celebrate with, you know, in DC. So we're all like, we're down in Georgetown having a great time. Monday's training. Monday, I remember I wasn't training in this because I had some sort of groin tightness. It was like a strain, but nothing serious. And we had a match for Sochaux on Saturday against Lyon, And that's a huge matchup. And I wanted to play against Lyon. Lyon's, you know, been played in Champions League like every year. And they had Juninho. Like it was a big, big game. So, I was like, I'm not playing that game. So Monday night comes. I'm like, let's go out and have dinner. Me and Stu, we're roommates. I'm like, let's go have dinner. Let's watch Monday Night Football. So we go out to Georgetown and I'm like, let's go out and have a couple of drinks. And he's like, no. I'm playing Wednesday, like I can't, but you right. go out and I'm like, well, let's just go out and listen to music then. He's like, no, I gotta go back. You go out and let me know when you come back. Like I'll make sure that, you know, nothing's wrong. So I'm like, okay. So I'm like, I'm not going to go out by myself. Like I'm not going to go to some random place and listen to music. Like we're in Europe. We live in Europe. I'm living in Europe. Like I want to be able to enjoy the States when I'm here. Yeah, it's okay. Like, go ask if one of your friends. So I call a friend. He's like, yeah, let's go hang out at the spot. I know the owner. Like we can go to the back room and chill. So we do that. It's like 2 a.m. I haven't had any drinks. And I'm like, oh man. Okay. All this emotion of qualifying for World Cup, like partying yesterday with the guys. I am tired. I'm going to go back. He's like, you sure? I'm like, yeah. I run into some people that I knew from I met them like a year ago and they're like, we're going to go home too. Do you want to come? I'm like, yeah, sure. And like, my friend was like, are you sure? You're sure? And I'm like, yeah, yeah. He's like, okay, let me know when you get home. And I get in the car, I'm in the back seat. And I remember putting on my seatbelt. And the next thing I know, I wake up, I'm in a hospital. It wasn't until a week later that I really felt like I woke up. So I had been in a medically induced coma for the first three or four days because of all the things that I had operated on my body. The car split in half. I was taken in a helicopter to the hospital. And I broke my right femur, my right tib fib, my left elbow, my bladder ruptured, countless fractures all over my body. But, My face in particular, I had a nose fracture. I think it was like my complete eye socket. They had to reconstruct my face. So I think what they started with was my bladder, then my leg, my left elbow. They kind of did it in each day. They would work on something that needed to be fixed. So with all that medicine, I didn't come to until probably, you know, if that happened on Monday night, I probably wasn't with it until Saturday or Sunday, something like that.
How do you process that when you finally come to, when you're laying in this hospital bed and you realize what has just happened? How does somebody process that?
At first I really didn't know how long I'd be out. I thought I'll be out for a little bit. I kept asking the doctors when can I be back on the field? I have a World Cup to play for and play in 6 months, and every time a doctor or a nurse would be like, I'm not sure, you know, everyone's different. But I had also heard he's done. I don't know if I went online maybe, or, you know, heard it, people talking, he's never playing soccer again. There's no chance he can play soccer again, let alone World Cup. Right. I knew that those were the conversations that were happening.
Right.
But I refused to believe that. Every day I'd wake up, I'd say, what can I do? I want to get going. I want to start rehab. I still had a catheter in, you know, I was still in the hospital bed and I was already thinking, what can I do to get going?
You can understand those sentiments or those feelings of people, because most are thinking, here Charlie Davies is lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking like, get me back going. I want to play.
Yeah. And I didn't know the severity of the accident until maybe 2 weeks in. A detective came in to the hospital and asked me, you know, what had happened. And then he said, oh, it's so sad that, you know, you're going to lose your career and that someone passed away and lost their life. And I was like, what? What? Oh, yeah. Someone passed away in the car, the passenger. And you're not going to be able to, you know, play soccer again. And I was flipped upside down because I really didn't know what had happened, or I just knew I was in a car accident. Didn't really process the severity of my injuries, and I didn't process how someone lost their life in the car. So all of that hit me at once. And I felt so much guilt and shame, and how I let down my teammates, how I let down the coach, how I let down my fans, how I let down my family. It was endless of how many people I felt I let down, how I took everything for granted. It was the lowest point that someone could possibly have. I mean, it's you could say, you know, you still have your life, which is what I think motivated me to get back on my feet and not sulk and not let this get the better of me, especially mentally. I knew I had to think about the positives. And every day, once I realized I had that initial blow of like, oh my God, what did I do? What did I get myself into? I gotta make up for this. I gotta make this right. And that's how, that, I think that's what pushed me, is I set the goal, which is get back on the field for the World Cup, as crazy as that was, but also I gotta make this right for all, right. Like, you know, you get in the locker room, that's your family. So I felt I had to make it right for them and the fans.
Charlie, I believe one of your legs is 1.5 inches shorter than the other because of this accident. You now have all this, you have this mentality where you want to make it to the World Cup, but you have this going against you as well, where you've got a long rehab and recovery in front of you just to have a normal life. And mm-hmm. here you are thinking about soccer. You teamed up with James Hashimoto, who's one of the physios for the U.S. Men's National Team. I believe you did it in Delaware.
Yes.
I believe Gooch was training at the same time there as well.
Yeah. So I was going to say, well, Gooch came into the hospital to see me, and he was on crutches. And I was like, oh, man, you were in the accident too? And he was like, go back to sleep, man. Go back to sleep.
Gooch is like your older brother, by the way. Yeah. Right? So people know this.
Yeah. And Gooch, luckily for me, he did his rehab with me in Delaware, because he tore his patella tendon in that game against Costa Rica on that Wednesday night. So I was fortunate to have someone who was a professional athlete also working to get back to the World Cup, to kind of push me, even though I'm starting on ground zero and he's just, you know, he's got his knee and he's, you know, doing that protocol.
I don't remember exactly where I saw this, but is it true that you texted Gooch that night and you texted him something to the effect, this girl's driving crazy?
I texted Gooch as well as I think my friend. I said, yeah, you know, I almost died twice or something to that nature. And then I nearly did die.
Our colleague Jeremy Schapp at ESPN, because you also now have collaborated with ESPN, he interviewed you, Jeremy Schapp. It's not just anybody. Jeremy Schapp interviewed you, and you told Jeremy Schapp in an interview that you'd be running by March and fit for the World Cup.
Yeah.
Obviously very ambitious aspirations. On May 11th, Bob Bradley came out and he said he made the announcement for the preliminary roster and you weren't on it. And he said the initial reason was that your club in France wouldn't clear you for it. Now, what's going through your mind? You have this goal of what you want to work for, and it's no longer there. What's left for Charlie Davies? How do you process this? What emotions do you feel? Is it anger? Walk me through this.
Yeah. Working my tail off, I'm talking 12 hours a day of rehab. That's what I was doing. And I get to France and I do start to run. You know, I start to train with my team at the end of March, and they're like, oh, you got some ways to go. So they send me to a rehab hospital in France on the coast of, off the coast of Bordeaux, by Bordeaux. And in that facility, it's called Capitan. I was also training with Ashley Cole and Michael Essien. and they were trying to get back for the World Cup. So again, I was around, you know, professionals who are trying to play in the World Cup, and
right.
that motivated me as well. I go back to France in April, and now I'm training mid-April. I'm training with the first team, and I'm like, okay, I'm on course to get back for the national team camp because I'm training. And as bad as I was, I'm still training. I'm physically fit because I'm on the field. And they sent Ivan out to watch me, who was the second trainer under Hashimoto, to evaluate me and see where I was. And he was out there filming me. I also ran into Pierre, who came out to Cabreton to talk with me and sit down and evaluate me. So I know I'm doing everything I can to put myself in a position to get to that camp. And I feel like I'm doing it. If I can train and I can play, then I was like, I deserve to get called up, like at least to come into the camp. I can do that. And that I think ultimately I would have been happy with that. Like not being selected, I knew I probably was nowhere near where I needed to be to get to play in a World Cup. But just to go and see the guys, to be able to say, I've tried my hardest. I worked as hard as I could to get back. It wasn't good enough, but just know I was trying to do all I could to make up for what happened that night, to be back with you guys. Like I wanted that and to send them off. That was my, I think deep down in my heart, that's what I wanted. So May comes and, you know, I felt like I'd made all the progress I could, but then I get word the day before that my French team is not going to clear me for this camp. And had they cleared me, I would have been called in. And then Bob would have gave me that talk. You know, this was going to happen. You're not ready, quite ready yet. Keep working. And then, you know, maybe you get called up when you're back to being fully fit.
Right.
But because my French team did not clear me, they were not going to allow me to go to the camp because their insurance would then be over and my French team would be required to pay my salary.
Correct.
And they were like, we're not paying you if you can't play. Like that's basically what it came down to. So, initial reaction, anger, because I was desperate. I was calling Gooch at like 1 a.m. Hey, you know, they're telling me I'm cleared, but now they're not clearing me. You got to talk to them and tell them, like, tell me what's happening. I was doing that type of stuff for 2 days straight. Bob calls me. I'm sitting there with my now wife and we're sitting on the stairs of my apartment. And he said, you know, starts off the conversation like, hey, Charlie, how's it going? We're going to have this talk. Eventually, you're not being selected for the camp. And as soon as he said that, my heart dropped and tears just started flowing out. And I'm trying to listen, but it's almost as if I blacked out and I've lost it because all this hard work and dedication was just to get to this camp. And now it's gone. And that's where I realized what the magnitude of this accident meant. The overall magnitude, I'm going to lose my dream. It's done. Now it's officially over. Sure, there was talk and there was the belief, but I really changed my mindset to believe that I can do this. If I give everything I can, I'm going to silence the doubters and I'm going to make it. That's over. And he told me, everyone's proud of me. I've done tremendous work and not to give up. And I just said, thank you. And I was trying to speak. I couldn't breathe. And I just said like, thank you, Bob, for everything you've done. And I wish you the best of luck kind of thing. Hung up the phone and just cried the rest of the day and night. And I didn't sleep. And, my wife Nina said, you know, let's go to Bahamas. Let's get away. That's what we need. The season's about to be over. Let's get away. We did. But you go there and then everyone's in World Cup jerseys. I think Aquilani from Italy was there. Like you're not escaping anything. You can't escape the World Cup. Week there and I fly straight to Delaware again to start rehab, with Hashimoto, who was, my savior to really get me on the right path to make it possible for me to play again. He always said, I'm Humpty Dumpty and you've got to put me together again.
Yeah. So. I imagine at some point you tuned into that World Cup and no doubt you would have been an actual part of that team because three players who actually made the World Cup had no qualification experience, and I was one of those players. Edson Buttle, Robbie Finley, and myself, all three kind of made it, and all three played forward. So there's no doubt in my mind that you would have been on that team. When you look back at that 2010 World Cup, did you tune in from the very beginning? Was there a moment tuned in from the very beginning?
I was not missing a second. As painful as it was, I was never going to miss anything, any action with that World Cup. I wanted to feel like I was there. I wanted to basically imagine that I'm in the locker room, that I'm on the bench watching these games, and that I'm a part of it, because I was so attached to the players on the field, the fans, everything. So as painful as that was, it's like stabbing myself while watching, essentially, is what it was. But I paid attention to everything.
Walk me through, if you paid attention to everything, you surely remember where you were and what you saw and felt when Landon Donovan scores that amazing last-second goal versus Algeria. And then to top it off, celebrates it the way he did.
Yeah, it was my 24th birthday, and I believe Bedoya was at my house in France, and Alejandro Bedoya was visiting me for my birthday. We watched the game together. We were cursing at the TV a bunch because we were frustrated. We were like, come on, we should be beating this Algeria team. And one of my teammates from Sochaux played on that Algerian team, Riyad Boudibouz, and he was talking ahead of this World Cup match that they were going to beat us, that they're so much better than us, that they have so many players. So I'm watching like, we can't tie this game. We can't lose this team. Like, we need to get through. The goal happens. We go nuts. I'm running around the apartment. Bedoya's running around the apartment. We're screaming. We're yelling. And then Josie calls me with Mo. Mo and Josie call me. And I remember being passed around the locker room and everyone talking, and then Stu and Landon saying they did the stanky leg on the field. You know, that moment will stick with me forever, because I felt like I was there, that they, you know, valued what my friendship was, that I really felt like a family member at that time. And, you know, it's as touched as one can be, you know, and it also just reminded me that this is one of the beautiful things about our sport, is when you develop these relationships and these connections with, you know, your teammates.
Hey, Charlie, it's unbelievable to me. I want to get into what now is this redemption story. I'm amazed not only that you were able to fully recover the way you have, but that you actually continued your professional career. And I want to go into now what is that DC United debut game. You signed with the Major League Soccer.
But before you get into that, I want to know from your perspective in that World Cup, it's Algeria. They're not the strongest opponents, but you get through. Because of the Confederations Cup results, in the locker room, were you guys saying, oh, it's a little bit like that in that instance that we can get to a final? Like, was there a belief that we had beat Spain the year before?
I think that the belief was always there, because if you recall the match before that, we were down 2-0 at halftime and then ended up tying Slovenia. And Mo actually scored a goal that was called, I don't know if it was called offsides or it was called a foul in the box, but it was, if there was VAR back then, it would have been allowed, and we would have won the game. We became one of the first nations to not lose a game being down 2-0 in a World Cup. So the belief was always there. I think that's always been the strong part of the U.S. men's national team. But now it's like you have a chance to either win the group if you win, or exactly out of the World Cup if you lose or tie. It was that close to group, so I don't think you had that room to say we're going to go on to the final type thing. It could have been.
What about after the game when you're going into that next match?
Oh, my goodness.
Was it we have the easy path? Like, were you guys thinking that? Like, oh.
No, I think the majority of people – exactly. That's what it is. The majority of the national team players are thinking, oh, it's Ghana. Oh, man, here we go again. Because it's a team, it's a nation that's always been kind of that pebble in the shoe of the U.S. men's national team. You know, I believe it was 2006, you know, that they – the game that happened, it was one of the saddest things I've ever seen. Claudio Reyna losing the ball and the way Ghana capitalized. So Ghana's always kind of been that boogeyman in a sense. And they were a very difficult team. And they were the last African team standing in a World Cup in Africa. So we definitely knew it was a challenge.
I thought maybe on the inside that you guys were thinking, you know, Ghana's not that strong, that this is the best chance we'll ever have to get to a final or get to a semifinal.
If you think about it, that would have been, because it was Ghana, Uruguay, that kind of, you know, side of the bracket, definitely a lot easier than the other side of the bracket. But, you know, and you know this, sometimes you can't get too far ahead of yourself. Sometimes you have to stay present in the moment. But the one thing I really enjoyed about that team, and you talk about the family that it was, I mean, I had been there 30 days before that tournament that started, and I did 0 games, 0 minutes leading to qualification. And I felt just as much part of that team because of the guys and the way they accepted you as probably the guy who had played the most games in that qualification. So it was a great feeling of this team bonding camaraderie mm-hmm. type of deal. But I don't think, at least on my end, that I ever allowed myself to get past the moment, you know,
because right.
it's, you know, it's one of these insane things. I was kind of playing with house money, you know. I don't know if Edson and Robbie felt the same way, but I felt very fortunate to be there. So it was a different feeling for myself.
Right.
All right. So Charlie, DC United, you know, yep. we've already been at this for like an hour and 25. So I want to, it's crazy. It just flew by. I want to get you your mindset, the emotional game that was you playing into your debut with DC United. Not only are you playing back at a professional level, but you just scored a goal, not just one, but two goals on your debut with DC United. I mean, it must have just been an emotion, a range of emotions flowing through you. Walk me through that. What is that feeling?
Yeah, I had a trial for DC United, one. And I think a lot of players – who, you know, are playing in Europe, playing on the national team, you're like trial for an MLS team. Like, no way. I was like, I know where I came from and what I've kind of had to go through. Like, yeah, I'll trial. You trial. I make the team because they're like, all right, we'll sign you. So heading into that first game, I had done well in preseason. I thought I was getting better with each match because, you know, I'm trying to build my match fitness up. Basically, these are the first real matches I've had in a year and a half. And 2 days before, Benny Olsen is like, you're not starting in this game. We're starting Nguenya and Josh Wolf up top. And I'm like,
Joseph Nguenya. Yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is, yeah. Am I happy? Am I excited? No, I'm not. And I feel like I deserve to start, but I'm like, okay, I get it. I got to come off the bench. So around, you know, halftime, I saw how the game wasn't really, you know, going our way. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get an opportunity. So I started warming up early. And I think around the late 50s, I came into the match and we get a penalty kick right away. And Dax is the captain and he picks up the ball and he hands it to me. And I'm like, oh boy. Like, all right, I'm ready for this. Like, and I banged it home, and that initial feeling of like scoring again in a professional environment in a match was, it was just magical, especially considering it's the same city that the accident happened in.
Correct.
I had doctors who operated on me and in the stands, nurses who helped me in the stands, you know, family members in the stands, Hosh who, you know, put me back together in the stands, all that emotion. I guess there was a slight, thought in my head that maybe I'm not going to be good anymore. You know, maybe I'm not going to be successful, or maybe I'm not going to be like impactful in a professional game. Right. And that goes away instantly. And then Charlie, to score again,
more invigorating. Is that feeling more joy or relief?
Both. Both. It's a combination of relief and joy and redemption. Right. Just knowing all that hard work was for something. It wasn't for nothing. And, you know, the game ends. I'm crying. I'm just so emotional. I'm crying. I can't get it together because it's like, fine. There is life after this accident on a professional level.
Right.
And I knew I had to take advantage of this opportunity, and it literally kind of just snowballed into getting more minutes in goal. And then I was
right.
A consistent starter and trying to get back for that Gold Cup for that summer.
I can only imagine. Wait, hold on. Now you're trying to get back for a Gold Cup? Is that what you just said?
Yeah. It never left me. The need or the urge to try and get back on the national team. That drove me. Like, I was always trying to do extra work.
I admire that drive. I admire it. I remember, you know, you and I have known each other since 2007. I don't even know when Twitter came out, maybe 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
But I followed you, and your national or your Twitter profile had always said U.S. men's national team number 9. And you mm-hmm. didn't change that, I don't think, until just recently. You've always had that mindset. Like, this is what I want to go for. This is who I am.
Yeah, and you know, there are a lot of times I think in people's life, and I think this is why I'm also meant to give back and to inspire and to motivate people and to give them some people an idea of how to do it. And so I would set a target or I'd basically trick my mind into thinking that it was possible, even if it wasn't. Just because if you chase it and you go as hard as you can and you work towards that goal, as maybe as unachievable as many people think it may be, you either can reach it or two, you come very close to reaching it and you surpass so many different things that people didn't even think that you'd be possible to do. So if I had U.S. men's national team number 9 up there on my Twitter profile, I felt like, you know what? I'm showing people I'm not giving up on this dream. I want to get back. I want to put on that jersey again.
All right. So I want to condense this next part because between DC, you went back to France, Sochi, that didn't work out. You had Randers in Denmark.
Didn't work out either.
Now, after Randers and you come back to New England, I've been injured, obviously not to the extent that you've had injuries, but ACL, cartilage, meniscus type thing. And there is a moment where your body's not reacting. It just won't do what you know you're capable of. Mm-hmm. Instinct's not taking over. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, whatever part of your rehab or therapy you are in, it just clicks.
Yes.
And then it's muscle memory back to second nature. Give me the 2015 season that is New England where everything just clicks for you.
So halfway through 14, I start playing with the Revs. So it took me a half a year to finally get like proper games and get a run. I finally get that run. And it was Jermaine Jones comes into our team in 2014. And with him in the team, I thought, oh God, this is my chance to get back on the national team.
Right. Because you got eyeballs on you.
Eyeballs. Jurgen Klinsmann, the relationship he has with Jurgen. And if I can show him and impress him every day in training and in matches, Jurgen's watching. I'm going to get my opportunity, right? So that 14 season really kind of changed everything for me because I hit those playoffs and I was scoring. I scored, you know, 2 goals in the first game away at Columbus Crew, then had a great second leg, didn't score, but played fantastic. Then the first leg against New York, our second leg against New York Red Bull to get into MLS Cup, I scored 2. So I had 4 goals in the playoffs.
You broke Taylor Twellman's record for goals scored in a playoff calendar year.
Yeah. So I was like, all right. I truly felt that January camp heading in for 2015, I was going to get a call. That's really how I felt. I didn't get it. Lee did. He had 18 goals that year. He was the third in MLS MVP voting, but I didn't get that call. And I was like, all right, I'm closer though. I got to be close. And Jermaine kept telling me, like, Jurgen's watching. He sees what you're doing. He needs a little bit more, right? So I'm like, I'm there. Like, I'm right there. So 15 starts, same thing. I'm like, I kind of hit the ground running. I'm confident. I know I'm the starting striker. They brought in Juan Agudelo, right?
Yeah.
To compete with me. And I thought, that's not the player we need on this team. We lose a center back in AJ Soares, but we replace him with a striker. Like, that didn't make sense. But again, me being me, I'm like, I'm ready for this challenge. I'll show that I'm the guy. I do. And I'm the starting striker for the year, but a U.S. national team call up never comes. And I think at that point, I'm like, maybe it's not ever going to happen. If I did as much as I could and I'm scoring goals and I'm still not getting called up and we're not really not having success in that position with the national team, I don't know what else I could possibly do.
I imagine that's deflating because you set a goal for yourself and you see how well you're doing and it doesn't happen. But in a sense, everything you live through, it's still very satisfying to know that your body's doing what you want it to do. Finally, you're back to that kind of beast mode mentality on the field where you feel confident about your physical and technical abilities again.
Enjoying the game. Like right. I could enjoy the game again because I knew, you know, I have enough pace to cause problems and I'm a goal scorer. I felt like I saw the game better. I could impact the game better. I thought defensively positioning, I could shield, you know, teams to one side. I could close down space. I could make it easier for the players behind me. I thought all those other things that you really can't grade with statistics. You know, when we talk about the analytical part of the game,
right?
You can't quantify how important a player is when it comes to the leadership and you know, maybe without touching the ball, being able to close down certain areas of the field and, you know, those other important things. I thought I did really well, along with being a great locker room guy, a motivator and a guy who could give inspiration. So I thought, I'm the perfect guy for, you know, a U.S. men's national team right now where they need a little injection. That's what I thought at the time, right? As well as just with my Revolution Club team, just being a great locker room guy, a guy who could always, you know, keep the locker room positive when you're losing six or seven games in a row, which we were doing in the summer of 2014, and we turned it around.
Yeah, absolutely. And that New England team brought back memories of the New England Stevie Nicol teams of old, how complicated mm-hmm. you guys were to play against. And I guess to end this, in 2016, in July 30th, 2016, you announced that you had been diagnosed with cancer. And I just see your story and I'm here talking to you and it's crazy how upbeat and positive you are. It's really made for movie-like story. At this point, I assume the sport is finally secondary and you're thinking about bigger things. And you really now are coming to grasp with everything you have achieved. What's the news like when you receive this?
Well, the first part of the 2016 season was 5 days before we're playing our first game against Houston Dynamo. My wife, we're going to have twins, her water breaks at 25 weeks. And I'm like, wait, this doesn't make sense. What do you mean your water's breaking? You still have, you know, 15 weeks or so to go. What do you mean it's breaking? It broke. We rushed to the hospital. You go through that whole scare. They're like, it looks like you're not going to have to deliver, but you're going to have to be on hospital bed rest for the rest of your pregnancy. And they allowed me to fly to Houston. So I fly to Houston with the team for the first game of the season. I score in that game. I think we tied 3-3. Come back. And then from that point on, I was living at the hospital with her. So I was trying to train and, you know, eat right, sleep right, being in a hospital with her. And eventually an injury catches up with me. I'm out for an extended period of time. I come back. Then my wife delivers at 27 weeks and 5 days. She delivers the twins. So now they're in the NICU. So for 92 days, this is how long they were last in the NICU. But throughout that time, I'm going to the NICU. So I'd train straight to the hospital till dinner time, or even past dinner time. We'd drive home and then the next day kind of repeat. She'd go to the hospital at 8 a.m. I'd train. We'd finish at like noon. I'd zip out of there straight to the hospital and be there all night. That caught up with me as well. I pull my groin. They are like, let's do an MRI to see how bad it was because I've been out injured basically the whole right. season. They're like, I think at that point, they're like, do we have to go out and get a striker? Because I don't think you're going to be, you know, available. And which they did. They went out and got Kai Kamara. The scan comes back. I have cancer. It comes back and they say, you have a tumor. And I have to go see a professional. At that point, I was like, okay, what does this mean? It doesn't mean I have cancer. They kept saying, like, this happens all the time. It's probably just, you know, nothing of seriousness. You know, we'll go get a proper ultrasound. I go get an ultrasound. In that ultrasound, I was like, I know you're a tech. You're not supposed to give me a heads up, but just let me know if it's nothing to worry about. You know, she's like, oh, I'll see what I can do. goes on for like 20 minutes. I'm like, do you find what you need to find? She hasn't said a word. She's like, yeah, I'll be right back. Goes away, comes back 10 minutes later and just says like, good luck this season. I was like, oh, I'm screwed. I am screwed. I go out to the waiting room. The trainer's there. I'm like, how bad is it? And he's like, yeah, you're going to have to see a specialist, a urologist in Boston. And at that point, I knew it was cancer, one. And I think two, it set in that I thought I had escaped death, like in the car accident,
right?
And just in life, that this was going to get me. I felt that I was certainly going to be heading towards death. And that car ride home, or I was going to the hospital, I didn't know how I could call my wife to tell her that I've been diagnosed, or haven't been officially, but they think I'm going to have cancer, and I'm not going to get to see my kids grow old. So that was what was going through my mind, was I'm going to die of cancer and I'm going to leave a wife and two children behind. So I get to the hospital and I tell her, and she had cancer when she was younger. She had Hodgkin's lymphoma. So she went through chemo and radiation. So she knows the severity of cancer and the kind of the fight that you have to kind of put up to get through it. And that was the lowest point in my life at that moment, was telling her I had cancer and thinking that I'm going to die and I'm going to leave behind.
That's, I can't imagine having to do that or having to go through what you've gone. Explain what the process is like when you're fighting this cancer, your status, your update now.
Luckily, I'm in Boston, and Boston is among the best cities in the world when it comes to healthcare and the doctors. So Dana-Farber specializes in cancer, and I was able to be put in touch with Dr. Wagner and Chan Rout, who are the best at what I have, the cancer that I have. And I had a family friend connect me to those doctors, which was incredible. And they brought me in, they talked to me, they made me understand what I have, and a liposarcoma cancer, which is very rare. And they found it on my spermatic cord, which is even more rare, right? So super rare cancer. And because it was caught so early, all I knew was a extensive surgery and no chemo, no radiation. So I did that. Then it was like a 3-month recovery, and it was kind of like, or 2 months recovery. And then I was kind of like, all right, let's get back on the field and play. That was like, I got to get back on the field. Like I got to come back from this. But I knew, like, soccer is just a passion now. It's right. You know, it's secondary. There's so much more to life. After the accident, I realized soccer meant less to me than what it used to. Before, it was all consuming. There was nothing else. But after the accident, it was, wow, there's life. But like, I appreciate waking up every day, and even more so now that you have children, and even more so that you can survive cancer. So I've been clear of cancer since that surgery, in 2016. So this will be 4 years, going on 4 years in, June, July.
That's amazing. And you announced your retirement in 2018. You have since started working with MLS, ESPN, the ACC network. You're now one of us in the media world.
Yes.
You're one of the most exuberant, passionate, positive personalities that we have covering the sports. I've been fortunate enough to consider you a teammate and friend. And I really want to thank you for this almost 2 hours. I know our producer will say the same because he's already sent me a message.
Hey, this has been the best interview. I literally enjoy this. I think you do a great job. I think you do a fantastic job. But two, like, I think that anyone that talks to me, what I try and do is I try and give as much as I can. And I try to hopefully inspire and motivate, even if I can reach one person, to let them know, like, you're never as low as you think. You always, it can always be worse. And the easy answer is death is always the worst, right?
Right.
If you're still alive, you still have a life. You can change the future with the mindset. Really, positivity. If you change everything and think about what you do have versus what you don't have, that's the difference right there. And what you can have versus what you won't have, That's the biggest difference right there. That's life right there. And it can change everything, our perspective. And, you know, as much as I can share to help people, that's great. And thank you again for having me on, because I really enjoy obviously talking about, you know, the sport and great memories that we've had. So as much or anytime you want me on again to talk and give you about different subjects,
we'll get you on, please, man. I appreciate
shoot me an email or text, man.
Charlie Davies, you can find him MLS, ESPN, ACC Network. Charlie, appreciate your time so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.